Chapter 14. When we got back to my apartment, Mouse shambled straight to the plastic punch bowl that holds his kibble. He ate it with a steady, famished determination until it was all gone. Then he emptied his water bowl, went to his usual nap spot, and slumped to the floor without even turning in a circle first. He was asleep almost before he stopped moving. I stopped by him to ruffle his ears and check his nose, which was wet and cold, like it was supposed to be. His tail twitched faintly at my touch, but he was clearly exhausted. Whatever it was about those barks that had impossibly roused an entire building all at once must have taken something out of him. I took my duster off, draped it over him, and let him sleep. I called Tomas's place once again, but got only his answering machine. So I grabbed my heavy flannel robe, for warmth, since the lab was far enough underground to always be chilly, pulled up the throw rug that covers the door in the living room floor, and stumped down the folding stair steps, flicking candles to life with a gesture and a whisper of will as I went. My lab had always been a little crowded, but it had become more so since I had begun teaching Molly. The lab was a rectangular concrete box. Simple wire shelves covered three walls, stacked up high with books and containers of various ingredients I would use, like the thick-sealed lead box that contained an ounce and a half of depleted uranium filings, and loaded down with various objects of arcane significance, like the bleached human skull that occupied its own shelf, along with several paperback romance novels, or professional curiosity, like the collection of vampire fangs the wardens in the United States, me and Ramirez mostly, had gathered in the course of several skirmishes over the past year. At the far end, on the open wall, I had managed to shoehorn a tiny desk and chair into the lab. Molly did some of her studying there, kept her journal, learned power calculations, and had several books I'd told her to read. We'd begun working on some basic potions, and the beakers and burners occupied most of the surface of her desk, which was just as well, considering the stains that got left on it during her first potion meltdown. Set into the concrete floor beside the desk was a simple ring of silver I used as a summoning circle. The table in the middle of the room had once been my work area. No longer. Now it was wholly occupied by Little Chicago. Little Chicago was a scale model of Chicago itself, or at least of the heart of the town, which had expanded from its original design to include everything within about 4 miles of Burnham Harbor. Every building, every street, every tree was represented by a custom-made scale model of pewter. Each contained a tiny piece of the reality it represented. Bark chipped from trees, tiny pieces of asphalt gouged from the streets, flakes of brick broken from the buildings with a hammer. The model would let me use my magic in new and interesting ways, and should enable me to find out a lot more about Gray Cloak than I would have been able to do in the past. Or it might blow up. You know, one of the two. I was still a young wizard, and Little Chicago was a complex toy containing an enormous amount of magical energy. I had to work hard to keep it up to date, matched to the real Chicago, or it wouldn't function correctly, i.e., it would fail, possibly in a spectacular fashion. Releasing all that energy in the relatively cramped confines of the lab would most likely render me extra crispy. It was an elaborate and expensive tool, and I never would have so much as considered creating it if I didn't have an expert consultant. I took the matchbox from my pocket and set it on the edge of the table, glanced up at the skull on its shelf, and said, "Bob, up and at 'em." The skull quivered a little on its wooden shelf, and tiny, nebulous orange lights appeared in its empty eyes. There was a sound like a human yawn, and then the skull turned slightly toward me and asked, "What's up, boss?" "Evil's afoot." "Well, sure," Bob said, "because it refuses to learn the metric system. Otherwise, it'd be up to a meter by now." "You're in a mood," I noted. "I'm excited. I get to meet the cookie now, right?" I gave the skull a very firm look. "She's not a cookie. Neither is she a biscuit, a Pop-Tart, sweet tart, apple tart, or any other kind of pastry. She's my apprentice." "Whatever," Bob said. "I get to meet her now, yeah?" No, I said firmly. Oh, Bob said, his tone as disappointed and petulant as that of a 6-year-old child who has just been told that it's bedtime. Why not? Because she still hasn't got a very good idea of how to handle power wisely, I said.
I could help her, Bob said. She could do a lot more if I was helping.
Exactly, I said. You're under the radar until I say otherwise. Do not draw attention to yourself. Do not reveal any of your nature to her. When Molly's around, you're an inanimate knick-knack until I say otherwise. Hmph, Bob said. At this rate, I'm never going to get to see her naked in time.